if a startup sits down with them and says, look, I understand that these are some of the problems that your business are facing, and here's exactly how we think that we can help solve them, rather than sitting there and saying, yeah, so what's your problem? And yeah, we can pretty much do anything for you.
Welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted, the show dedicated to innovation in the insurance industry. Each episode, you'll get a dose of thought leadership from the industry's top business minds, influencers, innovators, and executive leaders. If you want to transform your corner of the industry and exchange innovative ideas, you need to subscribe to this podcast. Now here's your host, Abel Travis.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted podcast dedicated to the topic of insurance innovation. Now, first and foremost, I want to say thanks for listening to the podcast. You know, we've had record downloads and listens over the last few episodes, and, you know, I've also had nearly 150 emails, tweets, and LinkedIn messages on the value our discussions on insurance innovation is providing to you. So thanks for listening and for your support as I walk through this journey of uncovering what really drives innovation in our great insurance industry. You know, so be sure to stick around for future episodes and tell your friends and colleagues to subscribe so you don't miss my discussion in late December with Daniel Schreiber, the Chief Executive Officer of Lemonade. Now, you know, I do want to thank our sponsor of this episode of the podcast, and that's Vortex Legal. Innovation in the insurance field is exciting, and Vortex Legal is a unique and proven solution to help improve a company's loss ratio by substantially reducing legal expenses. You know, their nationwide network of local attorneys attend the voluminous and routine and predictable hearings for a flat rate, not an hourly rate. So Vortex Legal's solution works with both staff counsel offices as well as outside law firms. They've saved many carriers millions of dollars. So if you want to learn more, just contact Jonathan Broder at 954-473-2648 or visit vortexlegal.com. Now, today I'm speaking with Stephen Goldstein, Country Director for Pivot Ventures, a launchpad focused on helping insurers and insurtech startups build successful and meaningful pilots and ventures. Stephen is focused on the Asian markets and building more collaboration opportunities between Asian incumbents and Western startups. Stephen is also an author for Daily FinTech in the domain of insurtech. Hey, Stephen, I do appreciate you being here. You know, great to have you on the podcast.
Hey, Abel, thanks for having me on here. I think it's great stuff you're doing, and I've been listening every week, so it's really, really good stuff you're doing here.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen. So, hey, if you don't mind, you know, just talk to us about your background and, you know, just how you landed at Pivot Ventures.
Yeah, of course. So apologies for those that have read this already in my first guest post in Daily FinTech. But my experience in insurance starts about 11 years ago. I started as a financial advisor in Scottsdale, Arizona. This was just after college. This was after a few, I call them failed ventures in the startup world, but they were more learning experiences for me. And financial advising was always my backup plan because my father's been in the business for 30 years doing the same thing. Was a financial advisor for about 2.5 years, which was going great until 2008 hit. And I, along with many other advisors, got washed out of that part of the business. And I decided that it might be better to sell a guarantee rather than sell something that was a bit more volatile. So I went and got a job at Jackson National, being an annuity wholesaler. So I was selling variable fixed indexed annuities. It was a good time to join Jackson because that was the time that a lot of other insurance companies went under from the annuity space, as you will have remembered. And Jackson then became the 14th largest annuity producer to number 3 during the time that I was there. Jackson's a wholly owned subsidiary of Prudential PLC out of the UK. And while I was at Jackson, I found out about this global mobility program that they had. And the program was designed to give you 3 rotations around Prudential's group, either in different verticals or different geographies or a combination of the two. So I had 3 rotations with them. The first one was doing a market entry for Prudential in Poland. So we were helping to set up a brand new life insurance arm over there. I was in charge of building the agency model. So it was in Eastern Europe and in Asia, agency models are very much a multi-tiered, multi-level marketing type scheme. So I was in charge of building how many tiers that we wanted to have, working with the actuaries and the product folks on the compensation arrangement that we would have built into the product, working with the operations people on what we needed to have there, IT, so on and so forth. So really the whole gambit. My second role, I moved into internal audit, and I often say this was for my sins. And the reason I moved into audit was my mentor at Jackson, who was actually the chief distribution officer at the time, had told me that if I ever wanted to run a business in insurance, that I needed to understand the risk management side. That was a very boring year of my life in the role itself, but it was a very valuable role in terms of my knowledge moving forward and how I could apply that to future roles that I had. My last audit in that role was auditing our business in Malaysia because of a persistency and premium churning problem that we had with some of our agents out there. Happened to find a few key issues, and they recruited me out there to help sort it out. After about 4 years there and moving from two different roles within the business, I realized I was a bit tired of climbing the corporate ladder and decided to take a break. I left at the end of December and had a knee operation in Malaysia. And 2 months later, my ex-colleague, George, who's the founder of InsurTech Asia and Pivot, contacted me and said, "Hey, looks like you might be a fit in what we're doing here, so why don't you get involved?"
So, Stephen, I think that's a great story, and I actually want to dig into two things even before getting into to what Pivot's focus is. So, one of the things that you mentioned was the failed ventures, and if you don't mind, I'd like to dig in a little bit about what those ventures were, and then how that sort of shaped the way for what you're doing today.
Yeah, of course. So, the first one was called the Cleanup Squad. It was a college house cleaning service for students by students. I started that when I was 19 and never made a profit. It really was a result of a conversation I had with a buddy overnight at drinks the night before, where we said, you know, it'd be pretty easy to start up a business. You just got to find something that people need and that they're willing to pay for. And we decided on house cleaning. So the next day I went down to the local Tucson Small Business Association. I was in Tucson at the time. Asked them, what do I need to start a business, and just started doing it. The second one was a healthy fast food restaurant. It was dine-in, drive-through, all organics and natural foods. Everything fell within a certain caloric and fat content, everything like that. And the whole thing kind of, I'll say, blew up, for lack of a better word, because of disagreements amongst the partners. So I guess the two learnings that I really got from both of those experiences, which I'm able to apply now, is have a solid plan before you start. Don't hire people before you have a business, or don't hire too many people before you had a business, because I hired a bunch of people for my cleaning service before I actually had customers in the door. And make sure that you partner with people that you can work with and do your proper vetting on them before you actually work with them.
Yeah, you know, Stephen, I think those are good learnings that came out of that. And a little bit later, I want to talk about how that applies to, potentially could apply to, how we innovate within some, you know, large corporations and large organizations. But, you know, so if you don't mind, you know, just talk us through what the focus of Pivot is.
Yeah, so Pivot is the business development partner of InsurTech Asia Association. So InsurTech Asia is more ecosystem level. It's more of bringing people together, having information sharing, best practice sharing, so on and so forth. As the business development partner, we focus on three things. So one is working with incumbents on their corporate innovation and digital strategies. Two is working with startups on their entry into Asia. So many startups say, hey, I'm looking to go into Asia, and they'll use it as a very broad-based term, and we'll say, okay, like, let's focus on which market is going to be most applicable to you. Let's do that market map, so on and so forth. And three is other strategic initiatives that come up that might be a bit more than just matching a startup and a incumbent. A lot of people ask us if we do funding, because ventures is in our name. We do not. But we do work with a number of VCs, both here in the US as well as Asia, and starting to develop that network in Europe. So in case startups ask us, do you have money? I can say, I might not have that much, but I have someone that does. So we can kind of solve all problems that a startup might need in terms of moving into a new market.
The second piece that you mentioned was, connecting startups with incumbent carriers. And that's, connecting potentially American or European startups or, just startup with the incumbents in the region that you're working in. Now, what insurtech or insurance trends are you seeing in the Asian markets that may be applicable to the U.S. or the EU?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question and quite timely as I was just out there last week. Now, I think the key distinction that I always make whenever I talk to startups that are looking to Asia is that Asia is many different countries. And if they've worked in the U.S., obviously they are used to having to work with different state regulators, but they still have one national regulator, which makes things a little bit easier. Now, I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's a little bit easier. In Asia, even if you work with the same insurer in, let's say, Hong Kong, and that insurer wants to expand that solution into Malaysia, it's going to be very difficult because they have two completely different regulators. There is a regulatory association which helps out with that, but it's not as free-flowing as maybe we see here in the States or Europe. So with that being said, I think, last week we were in Japan and Singapore. We also went to Hong Kong, which I wasn't able to join. And I took away kind of two things from that trip. One is the point that I was just making in terms of different markets. So when we were in Japan, a lot of the carriers that we met with, and the carriers were both on the insurance and the insurer and the reinsurer side, the first question they would ask us and ask the startups were, who are you guys working with in Japan? So it's very important that before they adopt a solution, that it's already working and already working in their home market. Whereas in Singapore, people were, the incumbents that we met with are more along the lines of, hey, is this something new? Is anyone else using it? Because, I want to be the first one to launch it, right? Which is something kind of similar that you might see here in the States. So that's the first thing, is that markets are very different. The second thing is that the focus is kind of the same, to be honest, that I'm seeing here in the States. So all the incumbents that we're meeting with are trying to find the right balance of doing operational efficiency activities along with innovation activities. So they all say, yeah, we want to launch a new D2C channel, or we want to start implementing AI, or we want to start doing this, that, and the other. But we've got this legacy system that we're trying to take care of, or we've got these other things that we're trying to replace, or we're trying to upgrade this thing, that thing, or whatever. And some are obviously further along at that than others, but they realize that if they don't take care of the operational efficiency bits, they won't be able to do the innovation bits. So they're trying to figure out where that right balance is for them. And I see a lot of that happening here in the U.S. from the incumbents that I've been speaking to as well.
I want to pull apart two of the things that you mentioned, or talk about two of the things that you mentioned. The first thing is, the regulation and how you recognize that going from one market in Asia to another country in Asia, it's going to be a very challenging from a regulation perspective. And in all honesty, actually, as I look at, let's say, the United States, because of the difference in regulation state to state, we face something that's fairly similar when we're talking about the different departments of insurance in the U.S. So, I think with that, incumbents and newcomers are going to have to find a way to navigate the change to adopt innovation under the regulatory constraints that we have and the multiple regulatory constraints or potentially opportunities that we have to work under. So I believe that, the two, as we're looking at, let's say, the startups and the incumbents, are going to have to collaborate with each other and then with the regulatory bodies really to keep pace with the new advances. So, Stephen, when you think about this, how can collaboration occur in a way that is conducive to growth and leveraging being able to take on board the innovation, but still really protect the consumer? Because that's a part of what the regulatory piece is about, is consumer protection.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think right now, so I'd say maybe 2 years ago, if you were reading about InsurTech, it was something kind of still unknown for people, right? It was slowly starting to get some speed, but the actual word was not in every single LinkedIn post that you look online when you go on there, right? Nowadays, it's everywhere. And I think that same buzz, I mean, obviously the startups have it because you see the number of startups that are coming in. But in terms of incumbents and regulators, they're all about it as well. And especially since they've kind of already had some of those lessons learned on the fintech piece, they're trying to say, okay, we got to get ahead of it on the insurtech stuff. Why do I mention all that? Because I think everyone's kind of running around saying, all right, we need to do new stuff. We need to implement some new things. We need to start partnering. We need to start investing. But the plan is not fully there for some of them, right? So I think you hit one of my favorite topics, which is collaboration. So a few weeks ago, I wrote about an article, or I wrote in Daily FinTech about different governments that are collaborating. And you see a lot of them are loosening up some of their requirements for startups. They're doing regulatory sandboxes, which allow them to do a trial, and so on and so forth. So I think for startups that are looking to go to those markets in Asia, they should be looking for the ones that are, that the regulators are a bit more lax in terms of letting them try certain things out, like a Singapore, for example. Secondly, I think that engagement in getting all three parties to sit down together is very important, right? It's easier said than done, but typically the insurer, the incumbent, will have that relationship with the regulator, right? And the startup would need to leverage that relationship in order to be able to sit down with the regulator and say, okay, this is what we're trying to do. What are your exact concerns? And how do we address that so we can make sure that it's okay, right? Just like you just said, so there's different departments of insurance here in the States. So in each country over there, I was most recently working in Malaysia, we have all the different departments there too. So when I was launching a app for our agents, right, we had to talk to the IT department, and then we had to talk to the pricing department. We had to talk to this department, that department. And they're not speaking to each other either, right? So they're kind of doing their siloed approach as well. So, and that's not that's not to ding the regulator over there, right? But that's just the fact of the matter. So I think for startups, they need to engage the insurer first or find the right partners that can then help them get in front of the regulator. And then together they need to be proactive to meeting with the regulator in terms of what that initiative is and how they can best mitigate the risk. Likewise, I can see a lot of action from the regulators happening, but I think they need to be brought on that journey as well, right? If we just give the keys to the regulator and say, here, go make some rules or go make some laws to govern this, you know, we're not sure what would come out of that. So everyone needs to be along that journey together.
Yeah, you know, I actually think that's a great point. And the way that you position this and the way I look at it is, to your point, creating a regulatory sandbox that includes the three. So the regulator, the incumbent, and potentially the startups, because as we know, the startups don't typically tend to have the, as you pointed out, the relationships with the regulators, where incumbents have been working with the regulators for a very long period of time. You know, what I always find in terms of getting others on board with an idea, and this goes directly to the point that you made, it really is to have them collaborate in the design and the development of that idea, because then at a later point, it makes it much more palatable when it needs to be implemented. So I really think that, you know, creating that regulatory sandbox is really going to be something that's important to be able to drive innovation within an industry like the insurance industry. I definitely think that becomes very important. Now, you know, Stephen, the other thing that you mentioned was really around incumbents finding the right balance between doing innovation and also operational efficiency. You know, so we hear a lot about things like digitalization of small commercial. And, you know, as we know, you know, small commercial is the more commoditized of the business, and carriers, though, they have a really tight stronghold on the small commercial market. Now, that's even with digitalization from, let's say, insurtechs that's trying to come in and help create not only the digitalization piece and the innovation piece around the technology, but also enable that operational efficiency. Now, you know, we haven't really, though, seen a huge shift when we think about market share to these insurtechs or even the partnerships that may come about through, you know, the efficiencies and through the efficiencies and the technology enhancements that some of these insurtechs are bringing to the table. But then, you know, I look to China and I look at insurer Zhang An, right? And it feels like they're doing it right. So what are they doing that we around the world and other places can learn from? You know, what are they doing right?
Yeah, well, I think with Zhang An in particular, look at their corporate partnerships, right? I can't recall the number off the top of my head, but they're able to leverage some huge, huge e-commerce platforms that are already being used by so many millions of consumers out there that they can just plug their stuff right in there, right? And I think that's a huge model that's going to come to the rest of the world too, right? So you look at a company like Cover, right, out of Belgium, right? So those guys are... So they kind of quote themselves as the world's first insurance as a service, right? And it's all API enabled. So they can go to pretty much any particular company and allow them to put their solution on and then package that with a new insurance product through an API, right? Lemonade's launched a similar thing, right? You're now looking at other companies launching products in terms of home sharing, car sharing. The guys from Shure launched something at ITC a few weeks ago in terms of, I believe it was a partnership with Uber, if I'm not mistaken. And so I think in order to really see scale for some of the insurtechs that are offering a new product, they need to see how it is that they partner with either existing insurers or non-insurer related businesses where insurance is an easy bolt-on to the core product that's being sold, right? And to your point, you're not going to see big swings in market share yet, right? Lemonade's been able to create a lot of buzz and get a lot of policyholders. But I read stuff that says, oh, well, they don't have the market share yet, right? Whether or not they're going to be the one or someone else. Insurance premiums take time. You look at car insurance, you look at home insurance, you look at some of these insurance products that are really more small premium size and they're pretty much paid monthly, right? It's going to take a long time for that to build up, right? Where these companies that have been around for hundreds of years have that big back book that they just collect their premiums every month, right? So I think it will take time. I think some of these ones that are cracking away at it are going to really, really make a disruption in the market. But I think it will be a good 3, 4, 5 years before we actually start seeing them taking over some sizable market share there.
And you did mention Lemonade, and you're absolutely right. While they don't have the market share, they're making big splashes in so many different places. You know, whether it's, you know, how quickly they've paid a claim or, you know, how they've introduced the ability to leverage their platform through the use of an API and so on, right? You know, but if I'm a large insurer, and let's say I'm working with a new entrant or someone like Lemonade to try to really adopt a more innovative process, you know, how do I understand then what my return on this investment or, you know, ROI return, I'll swap out investment to return on innovation. How do I really understand what that's going to be if I start to adopt some of these new market trends and technology trends into my value chain and how I deliver business?
I actually go back to what you and Andrew were talking about last week on your podcast, right? Which is around the economics of it all, right? So I saw yesterday on LinkedIn a video of a insurance agency that's now delivering insurance policy by drone, right? Now, I don't know if that's something that they just want to show to get some more attention or if it's something that they're really doing that they think is going to increase the customer experience, right? But I look at that. How much is that really going to change the economics of an insurance carrier's business, right? Whereas when you look at some of the things around wearables and some of the things around data and some of the things around claims processing and certain areas of the value chain that can be more optimized from a cost perspective, that's really what insurers need to look at, is say, okay, if I implement this thing, is it either going to, one, save me some money, or two, generate more revenue, right? And those are basically the only two key things, unless they have something in terms of like a risk or fraud problem that they need to solve, which is more of a risk management type solution. From a quantifiable aspect, does it save me money or does it make me more money, right? And as long as that question can be answered pretty easily by a startup, then I'm sure the insurer is going to be willing to listen more.
You know, Stephen, I sort of laugh when you mentioned the fact that there was a video of an insurer, or an article about the insurer that was delivering an insurance policy by drone. And you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, I'm not sure if that was just a splash that they were trying to make, but there's no real economics there. So while, yes, there's a capability to do that, I don't think that a lot of carriers are going to invest in that capability, because it's not going to hit the two points that you mentioned, you know, whether it's going to save them money or whether it's going to improve the economics through saving, or whether it's going to increase their economics through enabling them to improve their profitability and make some additional, you know, fund or money, you know, just in terms of either underwriting premium or reducing that expense ratio. You know, so I do think, though, about the risk taking that goes along with this. So there are all of these different concepts that are out there that these carriers are hoping to adopt, right? But companies really don't want to take that risk because they don't understand what that return is going to be. So there's a lot of carriers that may not want to invest in taking the risk. So, you know, from your perspective, you know, how do you make the case? If I'm someone, you know, that's sitting at my desk in a carrier, in an incumbent carrier, how can I make the case to invest in a new technology or something that's going to help improve the financials, where I know that companies may not be willing to invest in this unless they really understand the ROI?
Well, the number one thing is do your homework. Insurers and incumbents, whether it's a reinsurer or insurer, are extremely good at risk management, right? We overthink risk management. We have enterprise risk management. We have all these risk tables, you know, so many different ways to slice and dice how we manage risk for a company. It's important for startups to understand a bit of that, because ultimately every day insurers and reinsurers are looking at the risks associated with my business. And that's whether it's credit risk, market risk, non-financial risk, longevity risk, right? There's a whole list of them. And what they need to do is look at these different risk categories and then do some homework on the incumbent that they're trying to get pitching from and see what is it that this company's problem actually is, right? The other part, which is, you know, it has nothing to do with tech or anything else, is use your value of your network, right? So anytime I go and meet with pretty much anybody, depending on the level of the conversation, I'm doing my research on LinkedIn. I'm doing my research of what I can find online. And I'm going to, if it's a company I'm talking to, I'm going to try and figure out some stuff about the company from somebody that's inside. And these are not like deceitful tactics. An insurer will appreciate so much more if a startup sits down with them and says, look, I understand that these are some of the problems that your business are facing, and here's exactly how we think that we can help solve them. Rather than sitting there and saying, yeah, so what's your problem? And yeah, we can pretty much do anything for you, right? Which is what a lot of startups do, from my experience of being presented to by many startups in my previous professional roles.
So you talk about that, you know, the different startups that will come and, you know, present things, and maybe there might not be a lot of value based on what they're preventing, you know. So when I look at incumbents, you know, a lot of these incumbents are, let's say, starting innovation and endeavors by working and partnering, or, you know, through leveraging the technology that some of these startups have. Now, I'm just going to put it out on the table. You know, these startups may have the technology, but a lot of them may not have the real expertise. So, you know, some of the ideas that they put on the table might not be ideas that's going to transform or to really change the economics of an incumbent carrier or just of a large organization. So I'm thinking about what you do at Pivot. You know, are there specific ways that you identify ideas that's really going to show the most promise for the incumbents and for the startups that you work with?
Yeah, so I'll get to that. And there's one other thing I wanted to mention as you were talking there is when I talk to startups, right, in my role with Pivot, I probably talk to, I can't even tell you how many startups a week, at least 20 or 30. And my first question that I ask is, are you a solution for the customer or for the provider, right? And then what exactly is that solution that you're providing for? Now, if they can't answer that question, I'm saying, hey, let's go back a few steps before you talk to me about your technology. If they can, then I want to deep dive in that. And that's really how they can really understand it. Now, to your other point, I guess, you know, in terms of what I'm doing and what we do and how that kind of differentiates, I guess I help to do a lot of that research for some of the startups in advance, right? So I guess that's where you can call our value add. Is trying to find out as much about that carrier in advance. I also have the startups do dry runs with me as if I was an insurer that they're presenting to make sure that they're going to be snappy before they go meet the insurer. And I'll ask them questions that might come up too. So I guess rather than just plug myself, I think if people are looking for this sort of thing, so startups might want to get a good advisor on their advisory board that can really help out. That's been in that space. So if they're doing a solution for property management of water leakage per se, then get someone that's done claims management for a property company, right, on your advisory board. Get someone on your team that can help you on day-to-day questions. If not, then go find a consulting firm. I hate to use our thing as a consulting firm, but find someone that you can hire then that can actually help you to do some of that stuff if you don't have the expertise. Because I think the problem is, you know, if you don't have all that experience and expertise from working in the insurance industry for a long time, then you might run the risk of saying or making certain statements that actually derail you from what you're actually really trying to do. And insurers, at the end of the day, just like with anybody, when you sit down with somebody that you're going to be working with, you want to make sure that that person understands your business. So the more that startups can partner with people that are in the business, whether in an advisory capacity, a consultancy capacity, or just following more insurance influencers on whatever social media, to knowledge themselves up, the better.
Yeah, you know, Stephen, so you mentioned what you wrote about today. And, you know, that was around the topic of conflict of interest that we're seeing some of these, let's say, new entrants and newcomers talk about. And specifically, you know, what you were talking about was, you know, a lot of these startups saying that they'll never be in conflict of interest with their customers from a claims perspective, you know, because they're not going to profit off of denying a claim. And I think you're right. You know, as you think about what the insurance industry is here to do, it's somewhat misguided in terms of these organizations stating that, you know, denying a claim is what's going to lead to profit. You know, as an industry, we're actually here to pay claims, you know, based on what we've collected and based on the amount of risk that we decided to take. And as a policyholder, you know, we've provided what that contract was ahead of time. Now, you know, just thinking about that, you know, why do you see some of these newer entrants? And I don't want to say that they're saying misleading statements purposefully, but if I'm not really well versed in what insurance is here to do, I may look at that statement and think that's factual. You know, so why do you think some of these newcomers present insurance in this manner, which might truly be a misleading manner?
I guess when you're trying to disrupt an industry that's been around for hundreds of years and has been, you know, slow moving to adapt to change, as ours has been, you kind of want to shock the system if you've decided that you're going to go in and disrupt it, right? And I totally get it. And I think that I think disruption is good, as I say. And the first time I read that statement, kind of upset me, but I was like, all right, whatever, I'm going to brush that off. And then I actually heard it said again on your podcast a few weeks ago. And I was like, you know what? Like, if more and more people keep saying this, people are actually going to believe it. And like you just said, insurance, like, we're actually in the business to pay a claim. Like, that's what we do, is pay a claim. So to go out and say, no, you're in conflict of interest to do so, or insurers are in conflict of interest to do so, is going to completely miseducate people on this thing. Now, if these guys go out of business in a year or two, right, what skin have they lost in the game, right, from making such sort of statements? They'll say, yeah, we made our impact and we moved on, but all of us that are still in the industry might still have to face those repercussions, right, where customers are now asking us, hey, I heard that you guys profit if you don't pay my claim. Is that why I got denied? Rather than focusing on the actual reason of why they might have gotten denied in the first place. So I get it. I get that you want to disrupt things. I get that you want to shake things up. And I'm all for it. I'm all for the entrepreneurial spirit. Just for someone that's been in this business for a long time, I see that, and I kind of saw those statements as a bit irresponsible, because it basically undermines what we've been doing for the last few hundred years, which is paying claims and actually helping a lot of people.
And I definitely agree with that, Stephen. You know, so a question that I like to ask folks that I speak to on this podcast is, if there's something with me sitting at my desk, or, you know, with a listener that's sitting at their desk, if there's something that they can do to just change the way they do things and be a little bit more innovative and shift away from the status quo way of thinking, you know, from your perspective, what would that something be?
And oddly enough, and I never thought in a million years I would say this, but look at your risk management and contingency plans, right? So why do I say that? Because innovation is everywhere right now. There are so many smart people working on smart technologies that are saying, hey, this could be used for insurance. And they're completely right. And I think they go down that rabbit hole, they start developing things, they start figuring out how they can get it right. And when they look at it, they might not be fully looking at risk management and contingency. Or they might, but they might not be looking at it from an insurance industry perspective, right? So I've given a couple posts last week and a few weeks ago around risk management. And I think there's lots and lots of material out there to really understand ERM in insurance and contingency plans in insurance. Because if these guys that are doing the innovation can then tailor their risk management of their solutions around insurance, they're going to find out so much more about how the industry works. And then they're going to be able to apply that technology, because they've already got the smarts to be able to do it. So as long as they understand what are the risks that are inherent, and how do insurers and regulators look at and manage that risk, then they'll be able to tailor make their product, which will ultimately make it more innovative and more impactful for the people that are using them.
Completely agree with you. So Stephen, you know, I do want to say thank you for your time here today. You know, I truly appreciate you sitting and talking Pivot and what you're doing with me, and also your thoughts around innovation. You know, so I always like to say, you know, I don't want the conversation to stop here. And if anyone, you know, had more to add and contribute, I always ask that they, either send me a message or send me an email or so. But if the audience, or if anyone wanted to get in contact with you and learn more about what you're doing and your thoughts around innovation, how can that happen?
Yeah, so you can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can follow my weekly posts at Daily FinTech. And if anyone wants to email me, I'm at Stephen@pivot.asia. Just don't send me too much stuff.
I completely get that. You know, so Stephen, hey, once again, thank you. I definitely appreciate it. And looking forward to, you know, keeping up with what you're doing and, you know, reading more about your concepts and innovation in the insurance industry.
Great. Thanks a lot, Abel. And keep doing what you're doing. You're doing some really good stuff here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Hey, everybody. Now, once again, I do want to say thank you for listening to this episode of the Insurance Innovators Unscripted Podcast. Now, I do want to say thanks to the 4,000 plus unique visitors that we've gotten to this show. You know, as I mentioned, if you're learning anything from this podcast, don't hesitate to subscribe, or, you know, forward it to your colleagues to subscribe and learn more about what's happening in the insurance industry around insurance innovation.
Thanks, and I'll see you next week.